Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Issues in Sensory Integration and Fragile X Syndrome conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Robert Miller. Mr. Miller, you may begin.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. This is Robbie Miller. I'm the Executive Director at the National Fragile X Foundation, and this is the latest in our series of webcasts, audio conference calls that we've been doing for many, many years, and we're really honored tonight to have three very special guests on the phone with us. First, Jane Dixon-Weber, who is the Support Services Coordinator at the National Fragile X Foundation, will be my co-host for this next hour, and our very special guests are Tracy Stackhouse and Sarah Mouse Scharfenacre from Developmental Fragile X in Colorado, and they're here to talk to us about issues in sensory integration and Fragile X syndrome. And as our operator noted, in the last quarter of the hour, they will be taking questions. If everybody wants to look at the visual presentation that goes along with this this webcast, please go to the National Fragile X Foundation website, fragilex.org, where on the right side you will see, and some of you will have this in a link in your confirmation, but in case you don't, go to fragilex.org website. On the right side you'll see the word resources. If you hover your mouse over the word resources, it will say upcoming webcast. On that page, after the date and time, you will see two links for what says a PowerPoint presentation. These are actually going to be PDFs. If you're only seeing one, you need to refresh your screen since the second was added just moments ago. And these links will open up an Adobe Reader PDF presentation for you. So with that said, I'm going to hand this over to Jane. Mouse and Tracy. Welcome, you guys.
Thanks, Robbie.
Thank you, Robbie.
This is Tracy, so you can recognize voices.
And this is Mouse.
And this is Jane. And so as Mouse and Tracy go through their presentation, I'll try to prompt them for additional information whenever I think that it might be beneficial to all of you.
So okay, well, I guess we'll go ahead and get started then. This is Mouse, and we want to welcome you to our information tonight about sensory integration and Fragile X syndrome. And this is going to be short, but there's a lot of great information packed in here for you tonight. Tracy and I have both worked in the field of Fragile X for over 20 years, and we are so lucky that we get to work with these children and their families. We've learned so much in this short lifetime of working with everyone. As you know, we often speak of hyperarousal as being one of the most difficult things in Fragile X syndrome. But hyperarousal is only one of the sensory integration features that we're going to be talking about tonight. So go ahead and get your PowerPoint presentations up and get ready for a wild ride with sensory integration.
All right. And we'd like to really thank Robbie and Linda and Jane at the Foundation for pulling this together and for providing this service. It's really fantastic, and we're thrilled to be able to do this for everybody. So if you go to the second slide, what you're going to see is an umbrella, and underneath the umbrella are some bubbles. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the theory of sensory integration. And this is really near and dear to my heart as an occupational therapist, but it's a theory that that we have found to be really pivotal in understanding Fragile X and in providing appropriate intervention planning for children and adults with Fragile X syndrome. And like Mel said, when we think about Fragile X, we often think about hyperarousal as this huge feature that drives so much behavior. And many of the questions that we received in preparation for tonight were related to behaviors that are often thought of as being related to hyperarousal, things like hand biting and hand flapping and those kinds of issues. But there is more to sensory integration than just hyperarousal. So what I want to do is just spend a little bit of time talking about the theory of sensory integration so that when families are trying to get good intervention for their children or adults that are affected by Fragile X, that they can find clinicians who understand this theory, because it really provides an important foundation for a lot of the best practices that are suggested in Fragile X, not just from an OT or a speech-language standpoint, but from a behavior or standpoint, from a learning standpoint. So it's a really important foundation.
Tracy, can I interrupt you for just one moment?
Yeah.
In case anybody joined late, which often happens, if you go to FragileX.org, the National Fragile X Foundation homepage, and go to the word resources on the right, hover your mouse over there, and you'll see the option for upcoming webcast. And our webmaster has now added a third link where he's combined your two halves of your presentation into one seamless presentation. So I just wanted you guys to be aware of that. Sorry for the interruption.
No problem. Thanks. So we're on slide number two, and Dr. Jean Ayers is an occupational therapist who developed the theory of sensory integration. And in the umbrella, what you see are three bubbles that relate to the basic sensory and motor functions that we are interested in terms of how sensory integration impacts skill development. On the left side, you see a bubble that is called discrimination. And on the right side, you see a bubble called modulation. And the bridge between them is what's happening in the person's body and in their postural system. So I don't want to get too complicated, but what's really important is that when you hear about Fragile X syndrome, we know that there is an impact on the muscle tone and connective tissue issues, and we're going to see some postural problems because of that, problems with low muscle tone and getting up and moving against gravity, sustaining an upright posture, and not getting fatigued quickly are common issues that we hear really across the lifespan. Is there a question? No? Okay. So that's where this postural piece is kind of the glue between the discrimination and modulation functions. And because we know people with Fragile X are going to have some problems in that area, it's an important piece of the puzzle in terms of really looking at every age of development, what's happening with that person's body and how is their body helping them or not helping them, things that they want to do. So we'll talk a little bit about posture tonight. We're also going to talk about the discrimination and modulation functions. And I'm going to go into those in more detail in just a few slides. So when we talk about sensory integration, we're talking about this big construct that is related to discrimination, modulation, and postural functions and how they operate in day-to-day life for a person with Fragile X. If you go to the next slide, there's just a sort of summary slide that says that sensory integration does provide a strong foundation for us in understanding the complex problems associated, it should say, with Fragile X syndrome. And there are principles from this theory that help us. The next slide. There are some core principles that are really foundational to the theory of sensory integration that Dr. Ayers wrote. And when we are pulling together a treatment plan for a child or an adult with Fragile X, what we find is that these treatment principles really help us to do best practice. And that would be true if I was a school-based occupational therapist or if I wasn't an OT, if I were working with a child with Fragile X to help them learn anything. If I can understand these principles, it's going to help for that treatment to be much more powerful. And so we use these to evaluate programs like school programs, intervention programs of any kind. The first is that the activity that the therapist or the teacher or the parent is doing to help promote a skill needs to be purposeful to the child. Purposeful means that it has to be engaging for them and motivating for them, and it has to have a sense of being meaningful to them enough that they're willing to engage in it with you. The next principle is that the intervention should really be child-directed and very motivating for the child. This doesn't mean that we just follow the child around. It means that we meet the child where they're at, carefully evaluate their basic skill set, and then move them in a very incremental, step-forward direction, taking them from where they are to where we want them to go. So we aren't artificially creating goals that maybe are not around what the child is doing or related to what their skill base might be. The next principle is that we do use sensation as a very fundamental part of the intervention. And this is going to become clear to you as we talk about the theory of sensory integration and also some of the ideas around how that sensation impacts learning and development. And so there are some special things that occupational therapists learn about sensory processing that help them to know the power of sensation and how it influences the brain development and functioning, and that's a really integral part of sensory integration treatment. The last two are very related to each other. Dr. Ayers used this terminology, the just right challenge, to illustrate that when you're working with a child, you want to provide an opportunity for them to develop. And the best way to do that is to meet them where they're at and then to provide an opportunity for them to practice something that's just a little bit of a stretch for them, not too far that it frustrates them or makes it too complex for them, and nothing that's too easy or simple so that they are not engaged or bored. Believe it or not, we see lots and lots and lots of school programs where kids are kind of bored because people don't exactly know what it is that is interesting or motivating or captivating for that child, and they give them things that are too simple and too repetitive and not quite challenging enough. Figuring out this just right challenge is really an art, and it's really the thing, the developmental phenomenon that moves them forward. There's a lot of developmental science, even outside of the field of occupational therapy, that talks about how that just right challenge is the exact experience that creates change in the nervous system and allows for a new level of skill development. And that's what we're going for when we are providing treatment. The last one, a principle here, is what we call the adaptive response. And that's when the child or the adult meets that just right challenge, and voila, magic happens. Sometimes that's actually what it looks like and feels like in therapy, where you really have captured a moment where that child puts together a whole new level of skill, and they come out of it with a new level of adaptation. That's what we call the adaptive response. In any intervention plan, if you can put these elements into it, you're going to have far more success in moving that child or adult forward to the next developmental level. So that's kind of an overview of what we try to do in that treatment session. And if you go to the next slide, the button that advances the slides. Okay, here, I'll figure it out. Went away. Just scroll down.
All right.
Okay.
So on the next slide, we want to talk a little bit about sensory integration and why the theory is important. do we work on sensory integration skills only in isolation? Are they only important for those the theory of discrimination, modulation, and postural mechanisms? And the answer is no. The reason why we treat together speech therapy and occupational therapy is because we understand that sensory integration theory forms a foundation or a base for these higher level, more complex skills, such as exploration, such as, and at the top of that, we've got communication and cognition. So without having, when we do not have an organized sensory process, we often see difficulties in those higher level systems. So this again brings about why it's so important to be working and to understand on this, understand the sensory integration theory as a basis for these higher level skills.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second?
Sure.
I need to ask our operator. I've received some emails from people who would like to get on the call now. I'm going to ask our operator, is that possible, because the registration appears to be closed.
They can certainly call in and be attended to by operators who will place them.
Okay, the I'll give them the 800 number you gave me earlier. Sorry for the interruption, guys. Thank you.
Okay. So let's move on to slide number 6. And in this slide, what you see is a picture of the brain with some pretty beautiful blue and pink colors on it. And what this is telling you is that the umbrella slide that we looked at before that had discrimination and modulation as two main functions in sensory integration, this is related back to the sensory processing that's happening in the brain circuitry. So the picture you're looking at is as if you had kind of sliced the head open straight down through your nose, at it from your ear side into the middle of okay. The blue lines are showing you that the discriminative sensory processing goes from the body through the low parts of the brain, through the middle part of the brain, and up to the high smart parts of the brain where the cognitive processing happens. That's in contrast to the pink lines where you see this kind of circling and lots of information being shared in this middle deep part of the brain. So these are two different routes or pathways that sensation is processed, and those pathways are anatomically distinct for every one of our sensations, and that two system, we call that a duality in the sensory processing, is actually what is the base for this theory of sensory integration. The blue pathway, the discriminative pathway, carries information from your body up into your brain to tell you about very detailed information. That's why it's called discriminative. It's the system that helps you to feel the difference between a penny and a quarter in your pocket, even if you're not looking at it, because your skin receptors get very detailed information about size and shape, and that carries forward into the smart parts of your brain, and that discrete information tells you very discriminatively what is happening. So that's how that discriminative system works. It carries precise information from the sensory receptors, so from your eyes, it's carrying the details about what you see. It's not telling you if that thing is important or not. It's just telling you what it is. The evaluative system is the system that's more emotional in nature, and it's really doing that job of telling your brain, is what you're feeling, is what you're seeing, is what you're smelling important or not? Is it relevant? Is it something that you want more of? Or is it something that you want less of? Is it something that you want to approach? Is it something that you want to avoid? So that evaluative system is making those emotional sensory decisions for your brain about approach and avoidance. And it doesn't care if that is a beautiful green bug that's about to bite you or a beautiful blue bug that's about to bite you. It just tells you it's a threat that you need to get away from. The discriminative part of the blueness or the greenness is something that you might think about later after you've decided if you want to approach or avoid that sensory stimulus. So these two systems work in concert together, and in Fragile X syndrome, we know that there are disruptions in both of these pathways. The discriminative pathway leads to skill development. If you feel a quarter in your hand, can you use your fingertips to orient it to properly put it into the slot of a candy machine? That's the skill that comes from feeling the sensation and using those feelings to direct the motor action around a plan. So your plan is, I want to buy a piece of candy. You feel for the quarter, you pull it out, you manipulate it and orient it, and you put it into the machine, and then you complete your plan. That's how discriminative sensory processing is involved in motor planning. So you'll often read about the motor planning difficulties that we see in children and adults with Fragile X. And this is related to difficulties in this part of sensory integration processing. The evaluative system is the system that is telling the brain about approach and avoidance. Does that quarter feel okay in my hand? Is it something that I can manipulate, that I want to hold on to or not? So that's the basic anatomy kind of review. And if you go to the next slide, number 7, you'll see a graph that talks a little bit about praxis or motor planning.
Also, Tracy, I just want to, as the host here, I want to help keep the time, and I just want to point out we're on slide 7, and we're about halfway through our hour, so I'd just like you to be cognizant of that.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to roll here then.
Thanks.
So when we think about the motor planning part of this, what happens in motor planning is that your brain has to come up with an idea of a plan and then organize that plan and then execute that plan so that you can do the things that you want to do, like brush your teeth or play with a toy. And many of those things we learn through imitation. We know children and adults with Fragile X are generally quite good at imitation skills, and this is often a way that we can help them to learn things, because the sequential planning part of the processing is often an area of significant deficit for children and adults with Fragile X. And so we have to find a way to get around that. And all of that is based in basic sensation. The next slide, number 8, just is a reminder of the basic sensory processing mechanisms and how those are related to the pathways. So I think what we'll do is just go on to the next slide. And start talking a little bit about the modulation bubble. So we talked about praxis as that skill-based piece, and the discrimination processing leads to that. The other bubble that is really critically important to understand in Fragile X is the modulation bubble. And in the world of modulation problems, you're going to hear the term self-regulation quite a bit, because it is the way that we end up learning in our lives how to cope with the fact that we have too much approach or too much avoidance in the way that we're processing basic sensory information. So we'll talk a little bit about self-regulation tonight as well. So on the next slide, what you see is a basic graph that is used all the time in every bit of science to explain this function of modulation. It's often referred to as the Yerkes-Dodson law, and how it works is that in low states or high states of arousal, you see that at the bottom of the graph, your performance, which is measured on the left side of the graph, is going to be at a low point.
This is slide 10 you're referring to, correct?
Correct, slide number 10. And in the middle states of arousal, your functioning, your adaptive responding, your learning, your attention, your play skills, your language, all of those skills that we're trying to accomplish is always best if we're in a middle state of arousal. That's really common sense. We all understand that if you're sleepy, it's really hard to do your best on a math test. If you're really stressed out and anxious, you don't do very well. So at lower high states, your functioning is minimized. And when you're in the middle, your functioning is optimized. We know that children and adults with Fragile X have a tendency to have a very narrow range of optimal arousal, and they get shifted into hyperarousal quite easily, and that is going to right away minimize their performance. On slide 11, what you see is an additional function that happens when the nervous system gets shifted into that hyperarousal. Instead of responding to sensation in a neutral to positive manner, which is in the green, kind of green line in that graph, what happens when you're in hyperarousal is that, there's a big shift that happens in the basic sensory processing so that you start to perceive even normal sensation, just the feeling of your clothes on your body, the lights in the room, people looking at you, you start to take in that sensation in a negative manner instead of in a neutral way. And this is referred to as sensory defensiveness. It is highly troubling characteristic that we see in Fragile X syndrome. Tactile defensiveness and gaze aversion are two of the kind of key characteristics related to that.
We'll move on to slide 12 and talk briefly about hyperarousal, which really is the most prevalent and troubling characteristic in Fragile X syndrome. And if you remember that that hierarchy that we showed you earlier, it shows that when you have difficulties within the hyperarousal area, you're really going to see it affecting language, attention, social skills, learning, play, motor skill development. We see hyperarousal manifest itself across the lifespan. It does not go away, and it must be directly managed as part of life at school or in the workplace and at home. And managing hyperarousal is central to all of the interventions that are provided, learning, development, behavior, et cetera, et cetera.
So in the next graph on slide number 13, there's a nice graph that Dr. Hagerman helped to pull together. And this just shows in the left-hand box that there are some specific things that have been studied in animal models in Fragile X syndrome, with the fly, with the mouse, with all different kinds of organisms, as well as in people with Fragile X. And these are the biological phenomenon in that left-hand box that we know are impacted in Fragile X that lead to the anxiety and hyperarousal. And the anxiety and hyperarousal are what lead to behaviors like avoidance and hand flapping and gaze aversion and social anxiety, selective mutism. Many of the aggressive behaviors that we see in the individuals with Fragile X, as well as many of the features that are associated with autism and the overlap between autism and Fragile X syndrome. So those basic biological pieces are important to understand that there is a whole research literature. The sympathetic system is the fear, fight, or flight system in the brain, and we know that that system is prone to being really easily overactivated. And so people with Fragile X move into fear, fight, or flight very easily. The primary inhibitory chemical system in the brain, the GABA system, is not active enough in Fragile X syndrome. The amygdala is this fear, emotion, negative emotion processing center. We'll just think about it as the emotion processing center in the brain. And that is way too connected for people with Fragile X. And so they're very prone to having big emotional responses to things, and they get overwhelmed by emotion as well. The last piece that we know is that there's poor sensory habituation. What that means is that when you hear the faucet dripping over and over and over and over again, if your brain habituates well, it can start to ignore that sensation. We know that people with Fragile X don't have that ignoring mechanism, that ability to sort of screen out and filter out the sensation that's going on around them. And so the lights are constantly a source of irritation for them. The sound of the lights, all of those background kinds of sensations really are intrusive and overwhelming for people with Fragile X. All of those pieces together create this anxiety and hyperarousal profile. So on slide number 14, what you see in the red line is a person with Fragile X. We know that their nervous system is going to shoot up into hyperarousal. And what we want to do is come in with those proactive intervention and push that hyperarousal back down, push it back down, push it back down, push it back down. We don't want to push it down so far that they check out or aren't engaged or get bored or go to sleep. We want to keep it in the middle so that they really get a flow about their way that their brain is processing and how their body is working and how they're engaged in activity. And that is the formula that we try to go for in our intervention plan. Keep that hyperarousal in check and really proactively manage it. So I think what we'll do is we're going to skip over slide number 15, and we are going to talk about the sensory diet concept. Because this is really a cornerstone of doing this proactive management. People with Fragile X, whether they're infants or if they're in their 90s, need to have a sensory diet. It has become, over the last 20 years, a pivotal intervention. Regardless of the medications that a person is taking, there is no medication that is going to proactively manage that hyperarousal as well as a sensory diet can. So the sensory diet is a concept that was originated by an occupational therapist and close mentor and friend of ours, Patricia Wilbarger. It was originally developed for the treatment of sensory defensiveness, but we've been using it with people with Fragile X for at least 20 years and find that it's really a very powerful tool. It is a framework that is often used, should be used, for using the TheraPressure technique, the Wilbarger protocol. This is not the intervention we're talking about when we talk about a sensory diet for people with Fragile X, except in certain cases. So we'll talk about that in more detail in a minute. But a sensory diet is, on slide number 18, a method that we use to both treat the sensory defensiveness that we see in Fragile X, as well as the primary tool for maintaining an optimal state of arousal across the day to keep that hyperarousal in check. Slide number 19 just reviews that a powerful and precise sensory diet should be developed for the person with Fragile X. It's a structure that is based on routines and activities. And on slide 20, it tells you that those routines should be oriented around the transitions that are happening in daily life, morning to night, across the week, and also that the family lifestyle and preferences need to be included in that so that we're not doing things that don't fit with how that family's system works. We also often in a sensory diet are going to not just add activities that help that child or adult to feel organized and stay really in a calm, organized, engaged space. But sometimes we have to help people learn that maybe they're one of the sources of difficulty. So sometimes we have to modify interactional style. For instance, if a person is really annoying in the way they talk, or if they're real touchy and cuddly, that might not work very well for a child with Fragile X. If they just love their new Beyonce perfume and can't get enough of it and are coating themselves in it and coming to the preschool, probably not going to work very well for a child with Fragile X. We also make a lot of modifications to task and environment, and we'll talk about those briefly. So a sensory diet is set up with specific activities for that individual. It's not a list of activities that somebody gives you and says, here, try this. It should be a very prescribed program where the activities are selected for their power and precision in organizing the modulation system, and those activities should promote engagement and minimize hyperarousal. This next slide is number 22. And it is the basic structure of the sensory diet, and this is just a really brief one, just for an example. But it shows you on the left-hand side that you have a schedule, what's happening across the day. And then in the sensory diet, we're going to insert calming, specific calming activities that really help that nervous system to stay calm. We're going to evaluate transitions that are happening and pair those transitions with some kind of sensory anchor to keep that hyperarousal system from shooting up and getting out of control. We're also going to make environmental adaptations and interactional adaptations. So we do that very specifically throughout the course of the day.
Okay, now we're going to move on to what some of these specific sensory-based strategies are that are powerhouse strategies to shift kids out of hyperarousal and to keep that hyperarousal at bay throughout the day. So here we are. We're going to talk about deep pressure. Deep pressure touch is very firm touch, like a massage. It's very different from the light touch that we often use with students in the classroom or someone we might be talking to or working with therapeutically. So with kids with Fragile X, we want to use deep pressure touch and firm touch, and we want to avoid that light touch, which can be quite disorganizing for individuals. And so we want you to keep that in mind. The next one is proprioceptive input. And proprioceptive input is heavy work that makes the muscles and the joints work. And you can see in this slide that we've got four pictures of individuals that are using their joints and their muscles work. We have a little girl that's sitting in the back seat, and she's pushing on the driver's seat.
This is slide 25, correct?
Yeah, slide 25. Mm-hmm. And so she is providing herself with that that input through her muscles and her joints to get that proprioceptive input. We see the boy down below who is pulling against a bungee cord around the chair. And, again, he is also using his muscles and making his joints work. And then we have a little girl down below who you can see. She's wearing a weighted vest, and that's something that many of you are familiar with, using weights for a particular prescribed amount of time, not all day, to provide that proprioceptive input in quite a different way. Okay, we're going to move on here. This is just a way of using deep pressure input to help organize an individual. You can see here, this is a picture of Tracy. You can see that she's providing deep pressure into the chest while supporting in the back as well. Moving on. More work with heavy work.
Yeah, and this is slide number 28.
When we talk more about the proprioceptive work, it's that muscle and joint work, like pushing and pulling, any kind of movement of the body that works the body and works the limbs and the hands. You know, We think that proprioceptive movement is very powerful in the oral area. There's so many activities available on the playground that are wonderful, and we have kids provide kids with a lot of heavy work experiences during transitions throughout school or in therapy, as you can see with this young woman carrying a basket.
So just to mention the Wilberger protocols, because we get millions of questions about this, this is a technique sometimes called the Wilberger protocol or the brushing technique or the TheraPressure technique. It has a lot of different names.
Slide 29.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Robbie.
Okay.
And it is using this device, a TheraPressure brush is what they call it now. It used to use a surgical scrub brush in the years past. But it provides pressure input to the skin of the arms, legs, hands, feet, and back in a very specific way, followed by joint compression to all of the major joints of the body. It's a little protocol that is used to powerfully address sensory defensiveness, and it's used in the structure of a sensory diet. And we do find about half the time with people with Fragile X that it can be helpful if it's done correctly. But it is tricky to find somebody who's trained to do this technique correctly, and we would not recommend that you try to invent your own way of doing this or try it on your own. Pat Wilberger has also developed an oral pressure technique that is putting some pressure in a particular place in the mouth, followed by some pressure to the jaw joint. It has to be done in a very specific way by a trained therapist to teach the family how to do this. When we use that oral pressure technique with individuals with Fragile X, we find more like 75 or 80% of the time that it is quite helpful for those individuals that have oral sensory defensiveness in particular. So it is a technique that we often recommend, but again, it isn't something we can teach you, certainly not in a webinar. We use oral inputs in other ways as well. Sucking and chewing and blowing are frequently a part of a sensory diet, and usually this is also going to work a lot on teaching deep respiration. Deep respiration is one of the key ways that we can influence that sympathetic hyperarousal.
We're on slide 31 now, correct?
Yeah. Get that hyperarousal to soften out. Get that sympathetic fear, fight, or flight response to really shift very quickly if we can get a child or an adult with Fragile X to learn how to take a very deep breath. And oftentimes that can take many months to actually accomplish, just helping them learn how to purposely relax their bodies with breathing. And that's often something that we do in therapy. So you can go ahead and skip to slide 34.
Slide 34 addresses the use of movement as a part of a sensory diet. And remember, an occupational therapist is working in a very prescriptive manner to find the movement activities, the oral, the respiration activities, the pressure activities that are specific for an individual, that work for him. These are not activities that are just sort of thrown at the child or at the family. They're very prescriptive in nature. So, again, we use a lot of movement activities as part of our sensory diet. You can see pictures of the types of things that we engage kids in, and continued on slide 35. And then we also like to keep the hands busy. We like to say that busy hands are quiet hands, and we will offer fidget toys to many kids in a classroom to help keep them quiet and keep their hands busy. The same way, moving on to slide 37, that we put things into a child's environment, we like to take things away. And here's a young man who prefers to have these noise-reducing headphones on at certain times, so that the environment is less intrusive for him. And when he's comfortable, he'll take them off and interact, but he does use them in a way that's very, very useful for him. Let's see. We want to, we're on slide 38, and in terms of other ways to enhance the sensory diet, it's going to be so important to use these strategies when partnering with a behavior interventionist. You're going to be needing a behaviorist who understands the role of sensory integration with individuals with Fragile X. We want to embed these prescriptive activities into the daily routine, and we want to promote access to these things for the individuals and help them with self-regulatory. Almost done here. The next one, number 39, you can see a young man who is does have access to a sensory choice board, allowing him to choose which activities work best for him. So there we go. That's the end of that, and we're open to questions.
Very good. Thank you. First of all, I'm going to let those of you know who've emailed your questions. Because of our time constraints here tonight, I'm going to forward those emails to Mouse and Tracy, who have promised me that they will respond to those. So I think what we'll do here right now is see if there are any callers and have the operator let us know that.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if there are any questions, press star, then one on your touch tone phone. And our first question comes from Anna Maria. Please go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Tracy.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah. I'm calling because I was wondering if you knew anyone in the state of New Jersey, be it more close to southern New Jersey, there where I could take my son, where someone would really be qualified to work on some of the techniques you're talking about.
We do. If you can go ahead and send us an email through the foundation, I can send you the contact information for a therapist who has done a lot of work in Fragile X. She has presented with us at the national conferences a few different times. She took a leave for a while but has returned to practice in the last 6 months. Her name is Jenny Sammons.
Okay. All right. I didn't know if she was back in Australia. Okay.
So she is back in practice in New Jersey, and she's really a gem. So she would be a great contact. And we also have a few other names, so we're happy to help you with that. It'd probably be best to do that through an email.
Okay. And just a real quick question. Can I ask about hand biting and strategies for that?
Sure. Yeah.
Thanks.
You know, hand biting is a real common thing that we see in Fragile X, and it often has, you know, kind of ebbs and flows across the lifespan. What is going to be important is to make sure that your team is first addressing, you know, looking at that behavior in kind of a big picture way. And usually we like to do some kind of functional behavioral assessment with a team approach, so that we're not making assumptions about where that behavior is coming from, but really trying to get a handle on, is it coming from anxiety? Is it coming from positive emotion that just overflows and doesn't have a direction to go? Is it coming from boredom? Is it coming from a skill deficit and frustration? It's really critical to figure out what is the source of the hand flapping and hand biting, and sometimes it's coming from any or all of those things in a different situation. And then what we do is we map the intervention to the function of the behavior. So there isn't a specific thing that we do for hand biting, but we do know that a good intervention plan can really help to manage it pretty well.
Okay. Thank you.
Martin, do we have any other questions?
Yes. Our next question comes from Melissa. Please go ahead.
This is her husband, Robert. We were on together. On these sensory-based strategies, how do you determine which strategy to use or which one will be most effective to start with?
Well, what we like to do is this intervention is always going to be best if it's guided by a careful assessment. And so your occupational therapist should be helping you to determine kind of the prescriptive nature of those sensory interventions and matching them to what is powerful for your child. You know, what's powerful for one child is not going to work for another child. It really is a clinical decision that's made by the OT helping to guide you through that decision process.
Okay, Martin, do we have another question?
Currently, we have no further questions in the audio queue.
Oh.
Well, we do certainly have some email questions, which I'll be happy to read. Or, Jane, is there anything that you wanted to ask our guest tonight?
Well, I think it's what I'd like to maybe just briefly touch on is just how the sensory issues, you know, do go through the lifespan of the child. Or of the person with Fragile X syndrome. You know, it's not something that you just see and you can address when they're younger, but it's something that does need to be addressed through the life. And how does that change as they get older? What are some of the, do you see anything that changes as they get older?
Well, absolutely. You know, what we'd really like to see in an ideal world is, you know, that when the children are quite young, that the sensory integration intervention starts so that the child's really learning about their body, learning how to be planful and skillful and organized from the get-go, and that they also have a sensory diet in place that is going to start to build self-regulation. Because if we have a person who's 20 and they've never really learned how to self-regulate, it's a lot harder than if we are working with them developmentally all the way through their life and really helping them to get those skills. And we do see a difference. In one of the pictures that you saw where this boy was using a sensory choice board, wow, what a powerful story this little boy's life has been. He has had really good intervention since he was a little tiny, tiny boy. And he, in the picture, is a kindergartner. But he is self-regulating by using the sensory choices that he has learned from his team that help him to stay organized. And he is in a fully included elementary school setting. He has sensory choices throughout the school building. All of the adults in the school building know what to do when he needs those things. And he uses the sensory choices to get himself organized and regulated and then goes straight back to work. He never learned avoidance in a way that became maladaptive because he always had the supports to stay in an adaptive space. That is the story that we know can happen with good intervention most of the time. And so what we'd like to see in a really ideal situation is that that's what's happening across the lifespan. If a person is 25 or 30 and they haven't had benefit of that intervention, we know it's not too late. We provide intervention for adults even into their, 40s or 50s.
Yeah.
And, you know, these strategies can be included in their lives and they start to really feel the power of staying out of that hyper-aroused state, and it really makes a difference. So we know that the sensory issues don't go away, and like we said, there's no medication that really affects this in a way that's predictable and shifts it enough that it's the place where the intervention's going to, you know, that all you have to do is use medication. We really know that we have to have these sensory strategies in place across the lifespan. So it does look different from preschool, obviously, to adulthood. You know, as sexual development comes online, we often have to really ramp up the sensory diet to help with discovery of that as a coping strategy. So there are different things that happen at different ages, but it's certainly something that we see needing to be included you know, in a school setting, in a job setting, in a community setting, wherever the person is living.
Mouse and Tracy, I have some questions, email questions from Rachel. You actually answered one of her questions, which is someone ever too old for OT to show benefits? I think you've answered that. But Rachel also wanted to know if OT issues or sensory integration issues, rather, can present themselves and can be treated in individuals with a pre-mutation as well as the full mutation for Fragile X.
Absolutely. You know, we do see individuals that have a pre-mutation with Fragile X having many of these sensory issues, and the intervention is equally effective, and sometimes even much more efficient sometimes in those individuals with a pre-mutation. So we do see that the intervention needs to happen. You know, if the problem is there, if the sensory integration problem, whether it be a discrimination problem or a modulation problem or a postural problem, then the intervention needs to be provided to treat that problem. And it does make a huge impact on their daily life functioning. So, and I see that she had another question about dietary.
Yes. Do you want to read the question?
Sure. So the question is, are there dietary changes or interventions that have been shown to have an impact on sensory integration difficulties? From a research standpoint, not that I'm aware of, but anecdotally, we do see that there are children with sensory integration problems who the problems can be exacerbated by certain food sensitivities. That doesn't necessarily seem to be the case in Fragile X, but it does seem to be the case sometimes when sensory integration of problems occur without Fragile X. So if there are constipation issues or toileting issues, stomach problems, or other indications of allergy like skin sensitivities or rashes or things like that, then all of that needs to be evaluated medically and by a good dietitian who understands neurodevelopmental disorders. And sometimes it can be helpful to look at that aspect.
You know, I want to mention, since you did mention toileting, that we have a wonderful audio webcast, hour-long presentation by one of your colleagues, Dr. Karen Riley, on our website. And some of you who are also dealing with toileting issues might want to go back and look at that. Jane, can you say exactly where that is on the site? Somebody could search the site for toileting, but can you...
On our homepage, it's under intervention. If you hold the mouse on under intervention, you'll see a section just on toilet training.
Great. Thanks, Jane. Why don't we wrap up with a question, unless you have already addressed this and I missed it, about hand flapping. Sharon wrote in about her six-year-old son and really concerned that the hand flapping gets real out of control throughout the day. The reasons vary from simple excitement and joy of expression to overstimulation. And she's worried. He's been prompted to put his hands deep down in his pockets. I just wonder if you could address that. She's not so sure that that's the best approach.
Well, that's a good thing that she's thinking about that and thinking about the role of hand flapping. And when you're six and you get pretty darn excited and happy, you flap your hands. And it's a hard thing to self-regulate, to stop yourself. And with any of these difficulties within the sensory integration area and the hyperarousal area, if we're going to try and shift that response to excitement and that level of arousal, we have to meet it head on with something that's just as powerful and neurodevelopmentally exciting for the child as what the hand flapping does for them. And you know, sometimes we have we model for the child when they're very excited to push their hands together in their lap. You know, we can teach them to do wall push-ups. We can teach them a variety of those deep pressure techniques with their arms and their hands that can provide probably better input than just putting the hands in the pocket, something mm-hmm. much stronger.
And that's kind of like an in-the-moment kind of response where you want to try to match the affect and intensity. But it's also important to remember that it's better to manage this stuff proactively than reactively. So if you're waiting until he's already really excited and really hand-flapping, then it's going to be harder to manage than if you can see that, oh, we're kind of going in that direction, and help him to kind of take the edge off and bring that hyperarousal down a few notches. And then you're going to have less of an intense response in the first place. So those can be, that's actually, a really important and powerful thing to do, is to watch and observe. When you see that hyperarousal starting to build up, that you use some of those calming strategies that we've talked about a little bit tonight, and help the nervous system to settle down so that it doesn't hit that point where you're going to get that big eruption of response that is really what we see in hand flapping.
So if I had one major takeaway from tonight's conversation, it's that be proactive as often as possible, not just reactive.
Absolutely.
That's right.
So on that note, I am going to have to bring this to a conclusion. I'm sure many of our listeners are frustrated because you've just whetted their appetites. They've just got a taste of all the things that you have to share and contribute. But there is something that people can do about that, and they can hear you at the 12th International Fragile X Conference in Detroit, Michigan this summer, July 21st through 25th. You can learn more about the conference at fragilex.org on our website, right on the homepage. You guys will be there, and you will be presenting, correct?
We will be. Yes, we're happy to hear that all of our 10 abstracts have been.
Won't be quite that many, but we know you'll be there, and you'll be talking to people as well as making your presentations, and along with many other skilled therapists and clinicians and doctors and educators. Also, you guys are regular contributors to the Foundation Quarterly. If you're not a member of the Foundation receiving that periodical, please think about doing so. Great articles in there, and back issues can be found on the website. And I think we'll be having another one of these webcasts in the not too distant future, because you have so much to share. So I really appreciate that. I appreciate everybody listening tonight. And on that note, I think we'll bring this to a conclusion. Thank you, Jane Dixon Weber, also.
Yeah, thank you, Jane and Robbie. We really appreciate it. You guys are the best.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.